Tarago, you have a quick question for us.
Maybe I should leave that until after page two, but part two, because my question really is, assuming that we do not have an autocratic system, so I know best what to do, what message can we give to candidates standing for the next election to say, right, this is what we're going to do? I think that's the question.
Yeah.
Very much part two, John.
Great.
If I fail to answer it catastrophically, then you take me out from here. I know I'm going to fail to answer. Sorry.
But I think it was important to actually
Absolutely. Table
it now so that we can really focus on it. And the second person is Noah. Noah has already given us two presentations, very much on tipping points. And his presentations are also on our website. And this is Noah.
Just seeing the title of this part two, I suspect that you'll be getting into the territory which I was going to hope you would.
Another meal?
Well, I can't promise that. What I suspect, the question though is that just looking at the historical response of societies, of complex civilizations to these types of environmental stresses, one finds you often get towards these types of autocratic, warlike regimes. So I'm very, very curious as to the strategies one might lay out for navigating a non-warlike future that gets down to dealing with these crises, given that we've never managed to do it ever in the history of humanity.
And the likelihood of a transformation at this stage under this pressure is minimal.
Agreed.
Certainly without thinking outside the box of our normal democratic, autocratic, top-down managerial control systems, which are non-complexity designed.
So Eve
to the rescue, and I'll play Adam, and we'll see what we get. But the fall comes later. Eve, would you?
Yeah.
Please, other issues
yes,
that are
coming
out of part one, yeah. Please.
It's Jim Rowland.
Hello, Jim.
Yeah. How many other senior academics kind of agree with your analysis, like what would Jim Hansen or Miles Allen or people like that say? Kevin Anderson say to what you presented so far.
You see, the assessment of science by whether it's been peer-reviewed, who says you're good, who says you're bad, is the way we deal with the issues. My question is always, how close to the observable, analysable, real systems does this get? And the people with systems analytic competence come to me and say, David, I think you're spot on. Or there's a little bit here that you've missed. Or what about that? There are other people in the categories that you name, i.e. top climate scientists, who said, you have to be mistaken, it can't be like that. I hope you're wrong, and you shouldn't be saying anything in public anyway. Because it's not scientific, it's your opinion, it's not based on anything. And it's very difficult. People like Professor Peter Wadhams in Cambridge, one of the leading ice, water, surface, hydrology, cryology, picked this up. He said, David, you've just put your finger on second order feedback, the way one feedback mechanism sets off change in temperature, which drives all the other feedbacks, which reinforce each other and co-amplify. Nobody else has done that. People like Kevin Anderson said that the oppression of this material in Copenhagen last March was absolutely outrageous. He used one or two other words, which I won't repeat in front of the word outrageous, and fitted me in as a presenter at the end of his session as a result. The chair of the Copenhagen Science Congress was Catherine Richardson, wasn't she, on behalf of the International Association of Research Universities. She put an abstract in on my behalf to the Congress because she was adamant this had to be addressed. She set up a subcommittee to get permission to veto the authority of one of the session chairs, who was saying there can be no examination of the tipping point in the global system, only sub-tipping points. and she was refused authority to intervene in the Congress which she was chairing in order to put that agenda onto the board. I actually did run on my own authority on entrepreneurial behaviour and paid for it, a workshop in the Science Conference, right in the heart of it, in the room over the press centre, and I had three times as much input as any other scientist. And it nearly cost me my life. I had a deep brain thrombosis and lost a third of my heartbeats under the stress. It was not funny. And you'll find no reference to the input in any of the proceedings of the Congress. So, how do I answer you? People like Bert McInnes, one of the finest developers of system dynamics analysis software in the world, attended our working conference to set up the new modeling platform. Spot on with it. Jim Hansen and I do exchange information. He is not bringing in any account of the long-term methane release into his current predictions. And there are other feedbacks that he is not yet modeling effectively. So the 6 degrees sensitivity that Jim comes up with and defends very well, I think is still conservative and not yet coping with the speed of change and the dynamics in the system. There are scientists in Australia with whom I'm working literally on a fortnightly seminaring basis, and the same goes in other parts of the world. So a mixed bag. But I mean, Jim Hansen had vituperous life threats, obscene attacks on his ability as a scientist on a daily basis. I did a presentation at Westminster just about 18 months ago, and it was written up very beautifully on a website. And then there was a stream of blogs. In the heart of one was from an anonymous government scientist saying Dave was obviously a fascist because he was advocating the cull of the human species. He's the most dangerous person in the UK. I should consider euthanasia at the earliest possible opportunity, and both of my children should be neutered before breeding age. Which was an interesting response as a scientist from the government.
Okay,
okay,
there are two.
That has to be the end of that.
Yes. There and then, Alex. Can I ask you, please?
I will try
when
and
you
brief.
Yes, when you ask questions, say who you are and where you're from, just to give us some context.
I'm Graham, I'm a scientist. Right.
Hello, Graham.
Hello, David again. David is an esteemed admired friend. I'm not sure I'm any much more use than that to you, but nonetheless, work on everything you send me, fully supported. Which, very briefly, I will make a couple of observations on because it helps to expand what you just said. In 2010, it is 1913, which was the year before 1914, where big events happened. In 2010, it is 2 years before 2012, which has got nothing to do with the memes or telephone or film movies. It's got a lot to do with the rapid collapse, which is still ongoing, of the Arctic sea ice cover, which, from my score data, we think might unleash very quick and very lasting events. This is really people saying, look, no matter how many squabbles there are about academic precedence and priority and peer review and everything, there's one small problem. Buildings are right. What are we going to do about it? Stop squabbling in the bar. Events within the next 3 or 4 years are going to totally overwhelm not only the climate skeptics and the climate deniers, of all the academic tribal warfare. We are into the whirlwind. And I think this is something the general public is picking up very sharply now. They've got a fine-tuned bullshit detector for officials and politicians and what they're seeing on the television. I think that the tide has decisively changed in favour of those who have been talking like David for myself for some years. It's not really a profitable debate anymore to worry about whether or not we're being peer reviewed. It's whether or not, as David says, does it fit the data? It does. David was one of the earliest people I know to understand the sheer complexity, almost like the Copernican astronomy, you know, Ptolemaic epicycles, of the massive problems of climate change and the climate catastrophe that's inevitably come out of it if we don't do something bloody quickly. We're probably too late to do it, in fact. It's now about preparation, not remediation. And therefore, that's the context. Oxford's one, which David, I think, works. It's a very sensible ground state to be in. Anything less than that, pray to whatever God you believe in. Anything more than that is much more likely. And that's really one of the messages that we've all got together with people. It's only my own opinion. And that, on that point, I think you pick up the question is,
yes.
Which is, you know, how do we get over to people who share dire scale of the thing? The amount of denial, psychological and psychiatric,
which I think is very much similar to John's question. So I think we'll take that up on part two. Brief question, please, Alex, and
yes,
say who you are.
From a layman's.
Say who you are, please.
Alex Baskevas from Oxford Brookes University. Well, given this situation, what you have described, given the political approach to the thing, governments, given the denial from a large majority of the population, is there hope?
Well, there's an idea.
Is there hope?
See, we tend to split psychologically into hope and despair. For you, hope and despair. Whereas your right hand is the other way. And people say, David, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Mm-hmm.
And I come back and I say, I try with all my strength to be a realist. I won't try to dangle hope where it's not appropriate, or to use despair and alarmism to mobilise through fear, because that's an improvement. Let's stay with the reality of the situation, do our emotional work, and get engaged with what has to be done to the best of our ability. So, is there hope? Realistically, this is where I will be going, as a summary of part two, there are intervention processes that go outside the box of our current set of logjam political, social, economic structures, which can mobilise profound action in very large systems in very short time spans. That, I think, is where the potential solution lies,
exactly.
Which is why I value profoundly your invitation to give this seminar.
Yes.
I haven't seen that raised anywhere else in the field as yet, so this is with Tony Blair facing the questions down the road.
Yes.
Let's see if we can get a step ahead of the game.
Okay, so shall we go into part two?
Is anyone absolutely burning and saying, I've really been blocked? No, thank you, okay. I just thought I'd see if I could get a bit more respite before I start off again. Just check out, was my voice reasonably okay?
Yeah.
Evelyn is doing this to me from the back the whole time, but... Anybody else having difficulty? I'll take you to the hearing people on Saturday. You can come along with me and see. Seriously, okay, I'm fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
Thank you for that. Somewhere in here is my abstract. Part two. You have the abstract looking at the dynamics of social systems as they respond. In the situation, actually, not very good. The escalating rigidity, the complexity of command and control, and all the factors that grab it, lock it. A colleague in Brussels who talks about, we started off with Kurt Lewin's force field analysis, forces moving it in one direction, forces blocking it from the other. And the balanced feedbacks between them leave you walking the corridors of impotence,
mm-hmm.
where everybody else sees you walking the corridors of power.
Mm-hmm.
And your namesake, Colin Challen, the chair of the all-party parliamentary climate change group, APPCCG. Thank you. My false teeth always came. That wasn't on. After Copenhagen, he and I met in the corridors of impotence. He said, this place is insane. And he just shared, it is so hard even to hang on to your own sanity in the maelstrom of conflicting interests that block everything from happening at all, and that is success for the Klingon warship. Okay, Trekkies catch up, and others watch the box. Okay. Institutions of international negotiation are dysfunctional as a means of mobilizing effective global problem solving. Can you really take the seriousness of that on board? Dominance of powerful vested interests in the politico, economic, military, industrial economies constitute a virtual veto on essential action in terms of engaging with the fundamental problem. What they are vetoing is action that threatens their life support system in their economic and power and wealth generating domain. There is a war of the worlds going on. It is not the naivety with which many of us as campaigners approached Copenhagen. And, as we've already been beginning to look at, the psychodynamics of resistance to change, the anxieties that are mobilised, the flight patterns, the denials, the dissociative behaviours, all militate against effective action. And our resilience as a civilization decreases in the face of impending crisis. When it needs to increase in order to stay in touch with reality and solve the problem. Now, this is why 5 or 6 years ago I moved from my life's work on the dynamics of change in social systems, large and small, under conditions of high stress, rapid change and decreasing resource, where these behaviours come out in all their viciousness in the harsh reality of now, and engaging the reality of the context of the life support system and the necessity to intervene in order to generate a path of survival within which we can continue to develop, not just for my children and my grandchildren, who do exist, but unto generations of generations of generations. We're only the tiny fraction of what the human being might be and become. And you want to abort it now because you're making a fast buck. My Hebrew will come out, l'chaim, unto life. That is my dedication. Now there, I think, we have some motivation that is a win-win-win across all of human being at this point in the crisis of civilization. Gaia, the whole Earth system. I was calling it the whole Earth system until Jim Lovelock grabbed me at lunch and said, "Why don't you use the word Gaia? It's my invention." I think it's absolutely appalling that you don't use the word Gaia. And if I don't challenge you, my wife will take you to the cleaners afterwards. So I says, "Okay, Jim, you've got a problem with your wife. Let's." I don't care. Excuse me. I saw the look from the back. When he started using the word Gaia, it got targeted with all sorts of New Age fancy projections stuff. And he still gets statues of the Earth goddess through the post and stuff. But for him, this is a profoundly scientific concept of a very, very complex self-managing, autopoietic, self-organizing set of webs of complexity systems, of complexity systems, of complexity systems, that has an extraordinary capacity for self-management. Not at conscious level, but because that's the way the systems work. And I says, okay. Gaia consists of three fundamental systems: the geosphere, the physical, chemical structures of the Earth; the biosphere, life, very much confined to a tiny little layer around the outside; and out of that, a substructure that has now become a dominant structure, the anthroposphere, the human structure. And it's to the anthroposphere that we're going to direct our attention for the second part. A matrix of, Eve, I thought you'd like this one.
Yes,
I do. Get your glasses on straight. A matrix of co-evolutionary subsystems with an array of non-linear feedbacks between all elements. So, how do you get command and control structure to make that work quickly in a crisis? What's involved in this? Well, population, energy, you've seen a bit of those already, economics, resources, science, technology, industry, employment, the output, the entropy, the pollution structures, health, food, water, the means of survival, broke down in health. Agriculture, that wasn't there because they'd deforested and broken down their life support system. Politics, conflict, now they're getting stuff onto. War, transport, why did I put that in there? Because of urbanisation, and the polis is the herbs. Travel and mobility. Huge vested interest in that, aren't they? Consumers, media, values, education. And all of these sort of framed by the military-industrial complex, which is built up over generations. I'm sitting next to a general in the NATO headquarters for future planning in the States some time ago. And they put a general on everybody's table, I suppose, to keep us all in order. But anyway, this is sort of Club of Rome gala there. And I turned to him, I said, how would you propose to make war with no fossil energy? He never did answer. Religious beliefs become fundamentalist, exclusive, massively enforced during periods of rising anxiety. In fact, if you do a study of religious revival movements across the world, you see that they break out just before major systems go into breakdown. The religious system acts as a forewarning, the canary in the coal mine of social cataclysm and social disruption. Our anxieties go up, we need more certainty, religious revival will be provided. And it's happening, of course, around the world. Psychosocial dilemmas, the unconscious of the process. And if I ask you the kind of question that nobody knows, what's really unconscious of it? And you recognize that it's probably what you are unconscious of that drives the process that underlies the matrix of the complexity net of complexity systems that makes the anthroposphere not behave practically. Okay, let's move on. I was asked to do a keynote for the worst case scenario workshop for the Foundation for the Future in Seattle. Timing was early September 2008. Yes, 2008. Worst case scenario is accelerated by the collapse of resilience. We buy political power by decreasing resilience in the system. Ow. Economic implosion. If the value of the wealth to solve the problem starts to go down and pull the whatever, then we have less resources to engage. And blow me, 2 weeks later, with UK, Fannie Mae and whatnot, man. All going down the vortex. And the economist asks, what next? Well, what next was the immense release of financial resources to plug the vortex temporarily, but in so doing, decrease the resilience of the economic system, escalate the likelihood of further collapse happening. We're just getting warnings through from key analysts about where this is likely to go next. Well, I'm not an economist, and I'm not going to venture further down into that vortex, but the analysts that I'm listening to are making it very clear that the slight hold in the economic implosion is not likely to hold, and that the drivers of it have to do with our input of wealth, which has to do with our use of energy, and that that is now a critical issue for the future security of our global economy. And that maintaining exponential growth in the economy as a condition for political stability and social management may not be a sustainable strategy. Did you see the New Economics Foundation report just released 2 days ago? I don't want to leave the vortex up. Climate impacts, we've done enough of that. Resource deprivation. We are, of course, using more than one planet's worth of resources per year, and the amount of the more is increasing per year. So we're actually cashing in capital resources on an increasing basis. The more capital we cash in to meet our current account demands, the less basic structures there are to provide the harvest for next year. So the more we have to use of the capital. And that is one of those curves that goes into exponential power. Try talking with Mattis Wackenago, which is named Reese, on the footprint network, about the potential of where this is going. The breakdown of health. What happens if SARS had not been contained? If swine flu was much more lethal? If the American research molecular and biological chemists managed to make Ebola not droplet-borne, but airborne and survive, as they are attempting. I was working as a consultant with the World Health Organization, news came through, but while we were working together on trying to eradicate things like polio and malaria and so on, there was another huge amount of granting going in to making smallpox non-treatable with all modern drugs, so that it could be used as a weapon if required. Not to be of use. I do have some feelings about this. You know, I found that obscene.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely obscene. And while I was there as well, a group had been working on the effects of depleted uranium, the dust from it, in the first Iraq war. And the findings of that were showing up high degrees of associated long-term cancers and so on from it. And the whole study was vetoed by the American military intelligence. The data had to be destroyed. No reports had to come out of that. Otherwise, America withdraws its funding from the World Health Organization. And you talk about lobbying. The breakdown of health, the emergence of global psychosis. What do I mean? Well, something like this, in response to what's going on, panic, frozen shock, paralysis, stuck in the beams of the headlight mirror. Saying, yeah, we get delusion, schizophrenia, hyper-symbolic. The whole range of schizoid and near-schizophrenic behaviours begin to emerge within the collective behaviours. Or let's turn to something else, the anxiolytics. The increased use of anxiolytics under time and stress is marked if you look at it in history. Switch off. The denial of death and of grief. You know, when Al Gore wrote it, that first book of his, and he said, you know, we have to be able to weep with the tears of grief for what we have done for the planet before we can really see clearly how to engage its reality, or words to that effect. I think I got right enough. But then when he was doing some of his Inconvenient Truth presentations, he was saying, you know, we're caught between denial and despair. He doesn't, you know, denial is the river of the Egypt, and despair is the what you have in the trunk of the car, only they don't have trunks. They're not elephants. Right? And I'm saying, Al, okay, you try to avoid despair. Some of you here would have been through some of Joanna Macy's despair empowerment workshops at some nods around the room. You don't run away from despair. If you're facing a despair-generating situation, you find the courage with your partners, with your fellow travellers, to look at the reality of it, to face your emotional agenda, to deal with your rage and your grief and your depression and your darkness, and go through that into an engagement with the situation that really is, and try to make what difference you can. That work. And if you avoid despair and leave it in the trunk, you go nowhere in the car. Okay. And I appreciate this, and I've engaged with Al through one of his closest friends, because he is so traumatized through the near death of his son and of his sister. So traumatized through that election hanging. But there are areas of despair he cannot personally engage, and I think he is holding us back because of his own personal agenda at this point. And with all the love in my heart, help them deal with that, because it's a point of release that will engage in a totally different way with the realities of the problem. Okay, enough of that. Denial of grief. Splitting us then, good, evil, light, dark. Yes, massive splitting comes up, doesn't it? We find enemies much. I don't need to talk any of this. This is all obvious stuff. Fundamentalism. I got attacked by a Buddhist. I've never come across a Buddhist fundamentalist before. He said I was totally unenlightened because I cared about the world. I should be observing it. Okay, attack. How do you make war on fear without increasing fear? Oh, by the way, the level of terror has been upped in the UK. What does that mean? We're more scared? So you can see all these are symptomatic, I think, what's going on. Suppress information, that's going on, isn't it? Denial, escapism, heat and diversion, get out of the heat. Hoarding, greed, food, feeding frenzy, obscene obesity. And that isn't just about food and body size, it's about bank balance and stuff. And perhaps the dissociative behaviours. You know, you go on the tube and put a plug in. Or you can play on the fiddle while we're birds, but it comes to the same. Okay. I thought this was beautiful. This was the front page of the New Scientist last June. Some of you saw it. Gaia's evil twin. Life is its own worst enemy. And from this extraordinary fantasy that we have an ultimately dependable good Mother Earth, who is the source of all goodness, absorbs all our pollution, enables growth to go on forever, is there for us, caring for us, the great mother. We're beginning to find the other side of Kali, that the creator is also the potential destroyer. And that splits apart our defences of idealisation. Maybe we have to deal with the earth as it really is, rather than project our infantile, fetal ideas of an environment in which we get all the energy we need to continue exponential growth forever. We can dump our pollution and the mother system deals with it. We don't have responsibility for that. And provided you're not anywhere near birth, we can carry on growing with no constrictions. So I offer you fetal assumptions in the psychology of humanity as fatal assumptions in the civilization of humanity in the final phase of its last doubling in a limited global environment. The placenta is beginning to come under stress and there's nowhere to be born. Okay. There now exists a state of planetary emergency. Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. I said it at the Club of Rome in October 2005. People have said it around the world since. This is another one from The Economist. Now, what is happening? The Earth is in free fall, like an asteroid, hitting into some atmosphere, which is why it's heating up at the South Pole. Where is it actually hitting? It's heating up in Africa, actually. That's where the heat is really being felt. A sort of, the Earth has become Apollo 13, planet Earth. We have a problem, except there's no Houston doing the rescue. We are Houston. Parable, I think, for our time. Tiny spaceship with its life support system blown, having to take down its use of energy and get carbon dioxide that is threatening the life system, doing its strategic re-entry trajectory without enough control to know what they're going to make it, and still not knowing whether the heat shield has been damaged irreparably, and if they do get in, whether they're going to be burned alive all the way through. That's about the way. Gene Kranz, I think, was just awesome in his leadership style in Houston. You know, when the politician came in and said, Gene, I think this is going to be the greatest disaster in the history of NASA. He said, with respect, sir, from hindsight, I believe this will be NASA's finest hour. We won't see the answer to that in our lifetime, but maybe the great-great-grandchildren. We are effectively engaged in an asteroidal impact of global proportions. And the asteroid is us. There are some differences. That is almost instantaneous. We have had a slow burn. The asteroid is inanimate. We are not. The asteroid doesn't learn and is not a system of complexity. We are. And thereby hangs the difference between being the asteroid and engaging in a way of solving the problem that has, that has some hope, realistic hope, of making a difference within the time scale. So I thought, if I could take 5 minutes just to skim through some stuff here on the beginnings of this. Please, if this is raw material, if this is workshop level material, I don't think anybody has the answers here yet. But I'm hopeful that out of some of our discussions and the stuff that comes out of Beyond today, we can begin to refine some of the ideas that we get here. Yes, declaring the state of emergency is one thing. Engaging it. Now that's work. So let's get into a working engagement rather than just making noises about alarmists. Love this. This came out 20 years ago. A shift from organization to organism. Shall I do that then? I can find the reverse button. Yeah, there you go. It's a chip design, of course. From rigid. That's complicated. That's your background.
That's right.
Okay. This represents the kind of multi-matrix design of command and control in our political control systems that we have today. The shift from organization to organism of highly interconnected, nodal, parallel processing, humanity that takes responsibility into a distributed net, that is distributed processing, distributed intelligence, that has the capacity for self-mobilized organization rather than giving all the authority to that which can no longer work. Yeah, that's 20, 25 years old, that photograph. 2 years ago, factor of 10, Ivo de Boer, when he was talking to the business community in Bali, said what we have to do is turn around the supertanker of investment. No, it's not easy. Yes, we can use trim tabs on the back of it. It's hundreds of thousands of tons. Most of it's fossil energy anyway. We're going to dump it somewhere else, aren't we? It's controlled by one mind up in the master's turret at the back and controlled where it's going by financial vested interests of the rest of the world. If you treat the structures of authority and decision-making as a supertanker, and you can't think outside the box of supertankerism, then, frankly, there is no realistic hope whatsoever of making an intervention that would get to the right solution in the time frame we have. And it was at a seminar here, 18 months ago, that we reinterpreted from supertanker to shoal. From supertanker to shoal. And the shoal, just watch it. You know, shoal does all sorts of exciting things. It comes under attack, it moves as one, and then it relaxes back out again. They can go under attack again. It's an incredible pattern. The connectivity of each of these little organisms through the pressure cells down its body reflects what's going on immediately around it. There's visible signals, there's energy signals, there's all sorts of stuff going on. It moves connectively as one, it responds. It doesn't have a command and control structure in the central parliament that tells it what to do and how to avoid the shock. Particularly with the time frame of the decision making of the central proletariat, but the central Politburo actually is much slower than the response time of the shock attack. So it would not have survived. The dinosaurs who had that kind of decision-making process don't exist anymore. Supertanker to shore. What does it look like? Well, these are my first attempts at creating something of the massively parallel processing, virally replicating cellular structures of humanity, which with their interconnectivity, but not overactivity, can begin to get ahead of the curve of the urgency in the fierce reality of now. So maybe you can start with an individual, can't you? and add another and another. And threes are looking for another, but fours are unstable. So fours can look for pairs, and pairs can look for others, and triads can look for others, and fours are unstable. So maybe we can break into twos and. We begin slowly. It's not a supernova, it's a starburst. And they are totally different. Memories of Harry de Voice and the difference of opinion between how the society or organisation ought to get off to a big bang like a supernova in Europe. And he said, just the still small voice of starburst, the gathering under gravity and the beginnings of energising of a complexity net will make the difference.
That's right.
A big bang that levels out and plateaus doesn't do the job. And Sol went on its pathway, and we, I left, you eventually left, to run with the complexity of things rather than, what is it like, in a way, how far it goes? Replicating, two threes, fours, and then just going up. Even my newest Sony VAIO has difficulty loading that one. And the LSE does it better than I do, because it's a mainframe. Let's go back one more. Okay. No, just one. Do you mind? Thank you. Each blob could represent, say, three people. So these could be nines. Threes, six, nines, twelves, threes, six, nines, twelve, whatever. The connectivity between all of these is not just a rigid orthogonal. I couldn't do it otherwise. That's what makes the order creative. That's what begins to get the economy. That's what begins to get the value system changed. That begins to mobilise massive numbers in political lobbying and power. That says to the structures, change, engage, cut out the vested interests, go for the solution for survival. How do we do it? Well, one of the things is building into the structure capacities for replication. Most of our campaigning organisations work. We have a network. No, they don't have a network. And the net doesn't work anyway. They have a group for London that meets in a pub somewhere in the northwest. And this is for 8 million people representing. Excuse me. Cellular representation and replication is critical. Another 3 minutes. New start. Yes, you can start a group off from scratch and just go on adding up to whatever. Transition towns begin to start growing like this and get a good group going and reach a certain number of people and then it stops growing. Interesting. Transition towns has an internal structure to its engagement with an urban environment that is self-limiting and means that it doesn't change the environment. In a tiny village, it would be okay. In an urban environment, it's enough. And what's more, urban environments engage, but it doesn't reach critical mass. Buddy, it's asexual reproduction. Find three members within the group who have the guts and the resources and the support to launch out and start another one. And then you've got more spaces, and they can do the same. And maybe we can begin to develop family lines of parents and children and parents and children and parents. LSE, whatever. Insurance. Apparently, sexual reproduction is much more interesting, I find. Really have to be careful about it. Pairings, where two mature groups will come together for a day's workshop, one from each meets, one from each, really compare, cross-fertilise, change, take your time over it, then go back and say, oh my God, they've built something, we can learn from that. Again, find your core triad to make up the beginnings of a new group that is the child of the two groups. Much more learning, much faster learning. And that is externalised, and then goes through its own maturation process.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand that. You explained that within the groups you have certain little cells that then are multiplied themselves.
You lot are a group of a dozen people. You lot are a group of a dozen people. We have a dynamic workshop, one from the side, the one from that side, and we look back and say, what have we learned? What are the problems we're struggling with? What would we like to do? How can we do it best? What can cross-fertilize? We go back into a group, share something like that's cross-learning.
Yeah.
Then you find three people that you feel together, and they say we'll have a go, will be the seed that, together with those three, sets up the new group. And you will find your inner tribe, who will meet with their inner tribe to form the core of the new group. You don't need process it. You will stay in you will stay connected, you will stay in touch, of course. But it means that the group doesn't saturate, and the new group begins to form, develop its own inner life, and then go on to add new members to it. Is that a way of... It's okay. What I find is I have different ways of learning. And some of it's verbal, some of it's visual, some of it's dynamic. And I remember doing the workshop once and set a lot of notes before it to explain exactly the process we were going to go through. And people said, didn't understand a word of that. So I did a presentation like this, and people said, one or two people said, didn't understand a word of that. And I found that the person who actually had just got engaged to a dancing instructor and lived learning. And my guess is that you're more a kinesthete?
Yes.
Thank you. That's so important, and I missed it. The next workshop I ran, we sat on the floor, we actually modelled together the process we were going to go through. And he came back and said, I'm meeting somebody tomorrow night who's profoundly kinesthete, who I think is brilliantly intelligent. But has not been met by the educational establishment in the way they've been able to learn. And we need all the processes of learning. I'm sorry, I've gone on too long. Let's get this thing going. So maybe we can go on from that and develop my budding family lines of parents and children and grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren, who all stay in touch, don't we, as a family tree. And then, of course, we get threes and new groups and buddings and pairings and establishings, and we've got this kind of network, the interconnectivity of which, I suggest, allows massive growth in numbers, high interconnectivity, the possibility for, once it gets to the right scale, generating self-organizing movements, take the information and start to act on it and make it bypass the logjam that currently is holding us in place. And this can be applied to major campaigning organizations, to structuring business. There are all sorts of organizations that enable them to become resilient, flexible, creative, parallel intelligence, distributed learning. Each cell needs to become an effective, high-profile learning organization. Your Chinese experience, precisely. And the growth profile of a biological system of cells, this structure, the early field tests that I've seen in different parts of the world have a pattern of tripling in 6 months. Tripling in 6 months. That is colossal. Doesn't look much for the first year or two, does it? 3 years, 800 gigawatts. 5 years, wow, 60,000. 10 years, 3.5 billion. But it never gets that because we'll saturate, and these structures don't fit all. But this has the capacity to way go beyond critical mass in large systems intervention within the time frame that we have for problem solving. And I think the issues and structures and keys insights of complexity probably hold the only key for realistic hope in managing the way through into the future. I don't know if I can do anything. Now is the time for all people to come to the aid of the planet and to work together in a coherent system of complexity for the health of the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. We don't have very much time for questions, but I think we have had so much rich input that it probably takes us a little time to actually digest it. But nevertheless, please, you know, some responses from... Yes.
Looking at how to potentially
proliferate
and I think
Sorry, fear of what?
Fear of the...
The essential dynamics of the movement being
yeah.
watered out and becoming diffuse.
Exactly.
That would be, like, in complexity terms, where you have a vectored field of purpose, you actually begin to develop coherence and focus into a white-hot concentration on purpose that is then distributed through the proliferating structure. Fear not, it will probably get much more sharply delineated and blow you out of the water in terms of its capacity to generate increased commitment and coherence. But I understand the fear. It's there in all organisations
yes.
that face disintegration, apparently, of the control system. Let it go. It can grow.
Okay. Can you just say who you are and where you're from, please?
So, yeah, I'm Helen. I'm from climate as well as many other things.
You're a member of the Campaign Against Climate Change, pretty much, as others are, probably.
Okay, Eileen, I think.
Hello, Eileen.
Eileen Pond.
Back some.
Yes.
And I'm certainly in tune, of course, with everything David's saying. I just want to make one connection, though. That
mm-hmm.
I think I can't know exactly how it could work out, but I think that something that I'm connected with is a part of the unfolding jigsaw, and it's the community development movement.
Yes.
Because in that budding process, what's so important is the relationships between individual human beings. And the community development movement in this country specialises in how people relate to each other in communities. And it's had 50 years of understanding and working away, unrecognised, misunderstood and not understood in terms of what its gifts are. And so I feel that I'm involved in a new network that we found within London called Community Development Network London, which is about trying to get together the resources, human resources across London, who understand these skills. They may not understand this kind of theory, they may not even understand climate change. What they do understand is how human beings relate together in neighbourhoods and in areas where they come together to pool their activities. And it's interesting because I see climate change movement as full of very enthusiastic, energetic individuals, many of whom have no experience whatsoever in the community organisation world. And that's a very interesting dynamic itself, which is now happening in neighbourhoods. In my part of London in Peckham, what we've got are long-standing community organisations who understand the context of this kind of work, a lot of amazing infusion of new kinds of people into the geographical area who are enthused by these global ideas and the threat we're under. And so one of the big challenges is how we bring together these resources. And I think the community development world is a very important one to engage in this. And of course it also understands a lot of the psychosis, psychology,
indeed,
pathology issues that David knows very well.
But it can't,
okay,
it can't do it on its own.
No.
What we find, for instance, in the world, in the
yeah.
world development,
community development.
Is that the structures that you adopt don't enable you to go to scale. So this is something
yeah.
that you can take on board and make it happen. That the relationship structures in each of these little cells are critical, and we project into them and act out within them all our own psychotic defences, dependencies and so on, denials, and they become little points of personal integration and change. Almost because we have to deal with that, sorry, stuff, watch my East End land, in order to do the task. So we have consciousness transformation going to scale. And just to add on the end of this little one, the idea of salt cells. Salt are sustainability and learning for transformation cells, or
mm-hmm.
whatever you like.
Yeah.
But salt, you add it to your community,
yes.
and it really makes a difference. It's not tastier in the neighbourhood,
yes.
but you've got some salt cells replicating.
Yeah.
The trouble is salt cells are square in three dimensions, and they're inorganic. So I think yeast would be better than salt.
Oh,
never
absolutely.
Mind.
But I think it is essential to point, to think in terms of different scales, the micro as well as the macro, because the community by itself is very powerful, but it cannot do everything. Necessary, but not sufficient, I think
Thank
is
you.
The point. I've got three.
Okay.
One, two,
two,
three. But please Peter. Be very brief.
Mine's a quick point.
Peter.
The issue of hope, Peter
Chapman,
Christian Council on Monetary Justice. I've been onto these things in a crude way for 50 years, and my personal problem is keeping my resilience going. And Gramsci is the answer to me. I keep in my phylactery here. His great statement that he's a pessimist of the intellect, but an optimist of the will. And the whole question is, what will we do about the will in this description of building cells? The other thing is that very, very few people know how to hold a map in their mind, even the image of the Earth. And I've tried, and it's worked fairly well, to work with people saying, we are developing a psyche the size of ourselves in our present culture, and that opens up all the best of interest. What we need is a psyche the size of the universe, and humbly to find ourselves within it.
Yeah.
Now that's a great opener for discussions about the building of cells and the passing on of the information, with the resilience of our will.
Yes.
David, if we take all three comments or questions, and
then
you can respond.
Final
yes.
Yeah,
thank you. David, thank you very much for the
presentation.
My name is Ed Rosen from London South Bank University. I'll take away from this offering two very powerful images. One is the shoal with the shark, and I wasn't quite sure whether the shark was thinking, well, I'm outnumbered, I better retreat. The other image is the image of this, all of the clusters right at the end, at scale. I wondered whether you could share your thoughts on what is going on at the boundary of those organizations. One of the shoal is in motion, active, engaging with external threats. And your other image was less active, but very powerful and very present. Could you say something about what we might do around boundary work over the coming years?
So, do you want to very briefly state your comment?
Yeah, surprisingly, what I want to say dovetails perfectly with him.
Right.
Shoals.
We're already a group.
Yeah. Shoals, which of course have the same invisible brain that flocks of starlings do. There is a mind there, even though it's a ghost. And if you see flocks of starlings doing incredible things, you'll know what I'm talking about. Now, that biological replication, it's the same curve, on, if you reduce it by 10 to the 12, of detonation of a critical pile of uranium. It is fission. We need a critical mass, or we need a detonation process, what Lenin, in a misguided way, called the one spark that starts the prairie fire. What is the mean that travels through that flock of beings, us on this planet, like a uranium, that chain reaction, and stops everything else in its tracks that opposes us? Against the financial loans, we need means. And what are they? And how can we make them? How can we spread them?
I don't have to answer this one.
Right. Any response on those three? The shoal and the boundary.
Let's hold it to the boundary. We've got minus 3 minutes,
yeah.
I think, so we're fine. It's good. I love this pessimist-optimist bit. Pessimists are always such happy people. Because it's never as bad as they thought it was going to be. And optimists are always in despair because it's always worse than they thought. Than they have. But holding on to personal resilience. I mean, there have been times, Peter, as I worked on this, I put my head on my desk and howled as more data piled in and the reality broke through. I think each of us will find our own particular source of resilience. It's certainly driven me back layer by layer by layer to find, as it were, the irreducible core of me that will not lie down and die in the face of this. Ed, for boundary issues, the shoal was actually an unbounded shoal on that big picture. I show a little bit of it under attack for responding, simply to show how this kind of collectivity responds under certain stress of all of the things. The problem is we are, our own behaviour is the shark. I can't go further. I'm so glad these questions are being recorded. Come back, Graham. I want to pick up with some of Erwin Maslow's work here, when he talks about the learning curve and going to critical mass in social behaviours. He says, under very high stimulation and stress in a large social system, you reach a supercritical state where it's not about a learning curve reaching critical mass and being tipped into new behavior. It's a phase change in human dynamics. And you don't go around looking for trim tabs on rudders or supertankers. You look for the seed of the seed that initiates a phase change in a macro system almost instantaneously.
Elegantly put, but I was struggling.
What the hell does it look like in practice?
Yes,
exactly.
That's the question I was trying to put to you. Beautifully done.
Eve, thank you so much for the wonderful opportunity, and I hope this will be the beginning of ongoing work. May I just say, the Planet Earth, We Have a Problem is available. I have kept the amount available. The disc of the Taylor World presentation also available. They'll run on your computer or your telly. And some of you are already, I know, associates of the Union Programme, and put your shoulder into helping this happen. If you be prepared to help us in that way and actually become an AMP, an associate of the Meridian Programme, the more AMPs there are, the more power there is in the system, and you are part then of a growing global network that reaches, we hope, issues of complexity in a short time. Can I pass those round?
Okay.
Put them in the bin, give them back to everyone, or act on them according to your own.
Now, while those are passed over, I need to do two things.
Right.
One is to just add a comment in terms of the shoals and the boundaries. Part of the power is that, first of all, the shark will actually eat some of the fish, so some will be sacrificed. But the whole point here is that there's no central intelligence organizing the behavior of it. It's totally distributed. It is how each one actually is connected to the others, and together they actually respond in a totally self-organized way. And in the second one, I think the boundary is very difficult to show, because I think what you showed were circles. In fact, it is not a circle. It is something which is much more amorphous and is constantly changing, because it's constantly co-evolving and influencing everyone else across. So I think these are some ideas that we can explore some other time. The other thing I wanted to say are the three seminars that you have also as a handout in February. 24th of February, I think, it will be a continuation of today's discussion. But I also want to point out to two others, which I think are very valuable. One is will be leading a very practical workshop on learning how to actually build models. And the other is Dr. Paul Stevens, that even though the title, because he's dealing with coinage, may be, you may be wondering, what on earth is this about? I think what it is about is actually seeing how these ideas of complexity can apply to apparently in areas that may not be obvious at first look. And I think for those of you who are interested to explore ideas of complexity, particularly in different areas of application, then I think you need to hear Paul. Anyway, thank you very much for coming, everyone. I hope to see most of you again soon. And thank you very much, David. This has been quite monumental. Thank you.